Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Happy Friday! And to help you celebrate, today I have a brand new show for you, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. So thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on June 8th of 2025 under the headline, King of Moonshiners was an Old-Time Music Legend. Here we go. Among musicians and fans of old-time string band music, Benjamin Franklin Jarl is basically royalty. As a member of one of the most influential bands from the golden age of old-time music, DaCosta Waltz's Southern Broadcasters, Old Ben helped preserve that classic Appalachian Mountain style of fiddle and banjo string bands. His son, Thomas Jefferson, or Tommy Jarl, is maybe the most influential old-time fiddle player even today, 40 years after his death. In Oregon, though, in the years of Ben's youth, he was a different kind of royalty. The newspapers called him the King of the Moonshiners. And by all accounts, anyone lucky enough to acquire a quart or two of his product had to agree that the title was his. Ben Jarl was born in the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina in 1880, and he was the son of a licensed distiller from whom he learned the trade. The Jarls were particularly famous for their apple brandy, and Ben was always meticulous and professional in his craftsmanship. When Ben left the nest, he left the distillery and opened a country store in his home community of Round Peak. But he kept up his liquor making as a sort of side hustle, making the stuff on the down low, untaxed, and selling it to friends. "I kept up moonshining till North Carolina voted for prohibition in 1908, Ben later told legendary Portland Journal reporter Fred Lockley. "And then I quit, because I believe in the rule of the majority, and I wouldn't go against the express will of the fellow citizens of my state." The loss of income must have hurt, though, because Ben soon had a problem at his business. "I was running a store back home, and I was too easy, giving credit to the folks I had been raised with. I couldn't turn them down," he told Lockley. "I've finally gotten debt over $6,000. I can't abide not being able to settle my obligations, so I came out here to Oregon to make some big money quick to get my debts cleaned up." By this time it was 1916. Nationwide prohibition wouldn't happen until 1920, but Oregon got an early start on it, and the Beaver State had just gone bone dry. "In North Carolina, good liquor was going for $1 to $1.50 per gallon," writes historian Bruce Haney in his book, Oregon Moonshine. "In Oregon, now that prohibition was in effect, garbage bathtub liquor was going for $10 to $12 per quart. If Jarl wanted to raise enough money to get out of debt, Oregon was the place to do it. I figured if people out here were bound to get whiskey, I would furnish it to them a good turn by making a high grade of moonshine instead of the hair oil, varnish, and painkillers they were using," Jarl told Lockley. So Ben journeyed across the country to Oregon, put in 4 days of hard work, and headed home $1,100 richer. A year later, he made another business trip to Oregon. This time he brought two top-grade 65-gallon copper stills with him. These ran wide open for 2 solid weeks, churning out 45 gallons of top-quality white lightning every single day, after which Ben headed back home to North Carolina again with $2,300 in his pocket. Already halfway out of debt, Ben scheduled one last hurrah in Oregon, an extended visit on which he hoped to make $5,000. That would retire his debt completely and leave him with a little something left over with which to get into a less hazardous line of work back home. Unfortunately, Ben's reputation had started to spread in Oregon due to the quality of his product. Also, law enforcement officers had started figuring out how to sniff out a big liquor operation, and they had started watching the stores for bulk purchases of stuff like sugar and yeast and dried fruits and corn. So when one of Ben's helpers rolled into Walla Walla in Washington and bought a truckload of cornmeal, the transaction was noticed. And when the helper returned with the goods, he also brought a new customer with him. The customer sampled the product, pronounced himself delighted with it, bought a gallon or two, and headed off to the law enforcement agency that he worked for. And a few days later, Umatilla County Sheriff Tillman, or Till Taylor, arrived on the scene at the head of a 14-man posse to shut the show down. They pounced upon it late at night, after Ben had gone to sleep, and caught all three of the moonshiners by surprise. The moonshiners were marched back to where the posse members had parked their automobiles earlier in the night. Of course, it was pitch dark, and they were deep in the woods, so they made camp by the cars for the night, planning to head back to civilization after daybreak. "They made a little campfire near the autos," Ben told Lockley, "and as we sat around the fire, all took a few drinks from the keg they had brought along as evidence. I think all drank but Till. He wasn't thirsty, he said. As they were all talking about what good luck they had had in nabbing us, I made a sudden dive, like a cottontail, into a bunch of small pines. There was a hummock about 40-50 feet from the fire. I dropped it full length behind that." Ben stayed there for the rest of the night, figuring that if he tried to run for it, they'd catch him for sure. So he stayed put while the posse scampered around, trying to pick up his trail. Finally, they all came back to the campfire and sat around glumly talking about how fast he must have run to get away from them like that.
"It's no use cussing about him," Till said. "It was our own fault. I don't blame him any. I would have done the same thing."
Ben, of course, hit the road as soon as he safely could. He'd made it across the state line into Idaho before Sheriff Till traced him. He'd stopped for a visit with an old neighbor who lived there, preparatory to heading back home to North Carolina empty-handed. Till Taylor had no jurisdiction in Idaho, but he came out anyway. Ben was away from the house when he arrived, so Till left a message to telephone him. When Bill returned to the house, he did, and Till was out, so he left a "tag your it"-type message at the hotel. When the two finally connected, Till laid the pitch on Ben. "Come on back to Oregon with me," he urged, "and take your medicine. Otherwise, the prosecutor will probably get North Carolina to extradite you, and you'll end up getting arrested in front of all your family and friends, and it'll just be a much bigger hassle than if we just take care of this now." Ben said that made sense to him, and that if Till would let him come back with him like two friends traveling on the train together, no shackles, no extra law enforcement officers, yeah, he'd go. And so, of course, so he did. He ended up drawing a 6-month stretch in the Oregon State Penitentiary. After getting out, he didn't want to go home empty-handed, so he moved to Astoria and set up another still. But the magic seems to have been gone, or maybe the cops had just learned a trick or two. He was soon busted again, and back in the slammer for another 6 months. While he was in durance vile for the second time in Salem, he got word of Sheriff Till Taylor's death. Till had been shot in the back by an inmate during a jailbreak at the Umatilla County Jail. Somehow a gun had been smuggled into the place. Ben, from prison, scraped together $5 and sent it as a contribution to the Till Taylor Memorial Fund.
"I cannot express how sorry I was to hear of his tragic end," he wrote in the letter that enclosed the contribution. "It is a shame that a brave, good man like Till Taylor should have been shot from behind by a dirty cur."
Later that year, Ben was released from prison. This time he played no games, he just hopped on a train for home. The following year, in 1921, Ben dropped a line to his Portland Journal friend, Fred Lockley.
"I was known in your country as the King of the Moonshiners," he wrote. "Here I am known as Mr. B.F. Jarl. I have a nice business here, and I believe it will do well. Sometime write me a line or so, for I liked Oregon pretty well if they hadn't pestered me so."
When he wrote that letter, Ben had just moved with his family from Round Peak to the nearby town of Mount Airy, 12 miles east, and opened up a store there. In Mount Airy, of course, Ben's childhood friends were no longer able to come and charge groceries on account, so he was able to stay out of debt and prosper. In 1927, he joined patent medicine seller DaCosta Waltz and banjo player Frank Jenkins on a journey to Richmond, Indiana to record 18 songs for Gennett Records as DaCosta Waltz's Southern Broadcasters. It was then that he added founding father of old-time music scene to his King of the Moonshiners title. As far as I know, Benjamin Franklin Jarl never returned to Oregon, but you better believe his voice and the sound of his fiddle sure did. Key sources in this story included works by Bruce Haney, Celia Conway, William S. Powell, and Morgan John of Seattle old-time music band $4 Shoe. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. I sure hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do, or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show.
if you like listening to me, and you kind of think the Penny Dreadful scene of early Victorian London was kind of cool and fun, check out my other podcast that I launched at the beginning of this year. It's been evolving steadily along since then, and it's pretty close to taking its final form. It's a 3-times-a-week podcast involving chapter readings from 6 different Penny Dreadfuls, along with some other ancillary stuff that was published in the 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s in Old Blighty, the United Kingdom. I've been having a ton of fun with it, and I would love it if you could check it out and let me know what you think. If you have any suggestions or comments or anything like that, finn@offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up, and until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now!